Heterodorks. Heterodox dorks.
Hello, TERFs and trannies. Welcome to yet another episode of Heterodorks. I am your co-host, Nina Paley, a canceled artiste.
And my name is Corinna Cohn, an aspiring rock drummer.
And alpaca.
I'm giving up the alpaca thing because I felt like it was a burden that I just couldn't carry around anymore.
Beast of burden, yes.
A beast of burden. But Nina, arriving today, I got my Roland TD-17 drum set, which is an electronic drum set, and I'm going to be banging away on it. Sometime tonight, I'm going to be tapping away at some rock songs.
Wow. You identify as a rock drummer.
Well, I figured I'm going to be 49 this year, and if I haven't figured out what I want to be when I grow up, like, this is it. This is my last shot. Okay. And as far as I can tell, elderly rock stars seem to just have careers that go on forever. So that's what I want to be, is a elderly, decaying, decrepit, drug-riddled rock. I am drug-riddled. It's estrogen. I want to be a rock star that's just hanging on for dear life.
Nice.
I affirm that.
Awesome. You'll come to my show and you can catch me when I toss myself into the audience.
Awesome. I don't have the bone density for that, Corinna.
Oh, you're right. You need to start taking testosterone. And enough about me. We have a special guest with us. And because I'm suffering from memory issues, she just pronounced her name right before we started. Tabia Lee, yeah. Dr. Tabia Lee, but she goes by Lee.
Yes. Happy to be here with both of you today.
We're thrilled to have
you. Thank you so much for joining us. And I will say, if you have seen pictures of, is it Dr. Lee or just Lee?
Lee. I go by Lee.
Wow. Wow. That is so humble. Do you like not capitalize the L for even more humility?
I don't capitalize either parts of my name, but other people do. Yeah. That comes from long, long ago in my early education.
I'd be a little worried if I was going by Lee and I didn't capitalize it, because people would call me like Aye.
Right, right. Yes. I've been called so many things. I try to keep it simple with the one syllable Lee. Hopefully people will be kind.
So if you've seen pictures of Lee, she has purple hair in those pictures and she has purple hair in real life. And she had purple hair before it was cool.
Yeah, and it's not purplish.
No, but it goes in different shades and stuff. And actually, I taught middle school, and the way I started wearing my purple hair when I was teaching was one of my middle schoolers called me out on authenticity, because I was wearing a wig initially when I was teaching when I first started. Yeah, I was in my first few years going the early teacher training program, and I had perceptions of how should a teacher look. This was my own personal inner struggle. So I was wearing a wig every day to school. And one day, one of my middle school students said, you know, Miss, you're always telling us be our real self and all this. And like, we see that you have like purple hair, it's poking out under your wig, and you come up in here wearing a wig. And I was like literally called out. And from that day onward, I did not wear my wig anymore. The wig was off and I was just myself with my hair. Administrators didn't like it. Some of the parents are kind of like, what is that? Nowadays it's like, oh, that's a teacher, you know, but this was the early 90s and folks were like, what is going on? You can count on a middle schooler to call you out for keeping it real.
Yeah. Well, that's your natural hair color. You shouldn't dye it. You shouldn't cover it with a wig.
Right. Right. Yes. Yeah. Those are some of my best years with my middle schoolers in East LA. Just some of the most awesome kids, more insightful than many of the adults that were surrounding me at that time. And I really miss that aspect of teaching.
Well, why did you leave teaching?
Well, I got my doctorate. So I taught for 10 years in East LA, middle schools mostly. I also taught in a home for abused and neglected children, a residential home. That was my first teaching assignment in LAUSD, which was very tough.
God, that's tough.
As a first year. and then I invented civics programs. I did a lot of teacher training, professional development, department chairperson roles. You know, I felt like I had reached like my capacity, if you will, as a middle school teacher, and I wanted to have a bigger impact. So that's why I got my doctorate, which is in educational leadership and administration. And my plan was to still just stay in the classroom, but I ended up going for a couple of years after getting my doctorate and traveling to places I had always wanted to go and that I never had a chance to see because I was always just teaching. It was my life, you know, I didn't do anything else pretty much. And so I did a bunch of that, did some volunteer teaching, and then came back here, still job searching for that position that never came to fruition. And that's kind of the trajectory that I took. And I went into teacher ed at that time. So I was an adjunct teacher at multiple universities and couldn't land that tenure track for the longest time.
You said something that's interesting to me. You said you developed a civics program?
Yes.
What's civics?
So civics is knowledge of your country, your roles and duties and responsibilities as a citizen, and just what does it mean to live in a democratic republic? My master's degree, my research was action research on Latino civic competency because I was teaching in East LA, where I had a 99% student, a Spanish-speaking student group. And I found that the teachers and the students had low levels of civic competency. I mean, like questions like, who is the governor? Who's the mayor in your basic local government? And that was like deeply troubling for me, because if you don't know like the basics of, and you're a teacher or a student, of what it means to live in America and to be a citizen, to engage in your community and civic life, that's where we can get to where we are now in the nation. So,
well, for one thing, you can't really hold it against your colleagues or your students if they can't remember Jerry Brown. He's pretty forgettable.
Yes, but if we don't remember the past, we're condemned to repeat it. So that's where I always kind of come from.
It's my perception that this Generation Z, and maybe the millennial generation, don't seem to have a very strong grounding in civics. And maybe this is because I'm a Gen Xer and I'm starting to get old and crotchety, which it really suits me. But it feels like this younger group doesn't seem to have a very strong sense of feeling responsible for continuing the democratic experiment. It feels like they've given up in large part and are willing to toss it aside. And in my mind, it's partly because they don't have a very strong appreciation for how much work and effort and sacrifice it's taken to get to the point that we are right now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I would agree. You know, after I traveled outside of the U.S., that was a formative, shift for me. I just realized I was leaning this way. That was a formative shift for me. And I recommend a gap year to like everybody, because up until that point, I was someone who was just very critical and always pointing out what we need to do better, you know, and things like that. And when I went and did some volunteer teaching in the post-Soviet nation of Georgia, and I stayed with the host family, and they told me about what they experienced under Soviet rule and their paths for freedom and all of these things that I had never heard of or encountered. And I just saw the struggle of the people and how their hearts were broken. That gave me a new perspective of things and of what we have, an appreciation of what we have in America and a respect. They were really looking at us as a model. And I was like, wow, here I am saying like, we need to improve. We're far from the goals of equality of opportunity. Like that's always been my kind of thing that I focus on, looking at the margins. Who are we still leaving out? But what we've managed to accomplish against all odds, and as you mentioned, it is an experiment. It's something to be proud of, to honor, to value, to respect, and to realize that each of us have played a role in it and will continue to play a role in it if we so choose to do that. And I'm hoping more of us will choose to do that, because some people want to burn it all down and tear it down, and they haven't told us what's coming after they do that. So
I wanted to do that. I wanted to burn it all down and tear it down. And I didn't develop an appreciation for my country until I lived in India for 3 months. And then I grudgingly kind of changed a little bit.
It's amazing how those experiences, you know, it's different than looking at something on social media or hearing what an influencer tells you about another country when you're actually on in another land and you're seeing the people, how the day-to-day life is. And you start to think to yourself how things are back at home. And, oh, it is a home, you know, even though I'm highly critical of it. So,
yeah. I used to be, when I traveled, all I was thinking of is like, can I move here? Can I move here? I need to leave the United States because the United States is like a corrupt fascist corporatocracy.
Yes, yes. Those are theories I'm all very familiar with. So my doctoral dissertation was rooted in Frerian and Appleian theory, Michael Apple. So, yeah.
What did you say? Frerian?
Paulo Freire, yes.
I'm not familiar with that.
Oh, okay. So this is the author of Education for the Oppressed. This is where the idea of critical consciousness comes from. The roots of a lot of what teacher education programs are now focused on is Paulo Freire and a lot of his methodologies and thoughts around liberation type teaching. Critical social justice is what I call it, because it's gone beyond him even and into other topics nowadays. So yeah, I'm very familiar with the theories. What they're doing now with them and what scholar activists have done, I don't know if even the theorists themselves would recognize their work anymore. I mean,
okay, so you're against liberation and justice.
Oh, no. I'm definitely, definitely not against it. Oh my gosh. No, not at all.
But of course you are. We all are. We're all a bunch of horrible fascists who want vulnerable people to die. There's no other explanation for it, right? I'm not.
Not me.
Just you, Nina.
Just me. Okay. There's no other explanation for me. Okay. So what's your excuse, Lee? Mine is that I'm a horrible person who wants people to die.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't want anyone to die or any of that. I'm someone, I like life and living, and I'm a very hopeful person. I always have been. That's just like my nature. Even now, like today in today's world, as upside down and weird as it is, I still have hope that we're going to turn it around. I know some people have like given up, or they're like, oh, we're never going to get out of this. It's gone too far. Like, I'm not someone who ever believes that. I think I'm just always a hopeful person. There's better to come. There has to be. It's something about me. I don't know.
Well, I guess you'd have to be that way to be a teacher.
Yeah. And I still have hope for teachers and education and the education field. I think that the teachers have given up a lot of viewing it as a craft, and they've ceded a lot of their innovation and creativity to like outside consultants and people that come in and tell them what they should be doing, instead of teachers forming that and working together with their colleagues at all levels, K through 12, higher ed. You know, I thought I was going into higher ed to become a professor and that I would be working with colleagues and an academic senate. That was all a fantasy. Like, those are gone now. They've been overtaken by ideologues, and there's no like real process that's happening beyond like, how do we show fidelity to our DEI policy? How do we show that we're just warriors for gender identity politics? That's what it's about now. So if you have any kind of, if you're trying to engage people in any kind of like critical thinking about that or questioning, you're outcast. At least I was. Maybe I was special. Yeah, because I was really just tossed out just for doing things like that, making space, and told that I was a dangerous person for doing that. So.
Well, that's what I was saying. You're dangerous because you're against liberation.
No, I'm not.
Justice. Well, you have to be, right? Because you're dangerous. There's no other reason. I mean, those people can't be wrong, right? Like, they run the schools.
You know, it's just hard, though, because for me, anytime something becomes like a mandate, I start to question it. I've just always been that way. So when people started saying, we all need to say our pronouns and have it in our email signature and ask our students their pronouns when they first come in to make a belonging environment. I'm like, wait, no, we all have to do that? Like, I would just ask questions. And then I'm like, you know, I was doing it before, but now I'm actually taking that out of my signature because I don't know why it's a mandate and why this is happening, you know? And the way that it was introduced was like, you will do. And I'm like, no, I can't. Like, there's something inside of me that goes like, huh? Okay, I'm gonna not do that just because you've told me that I must do it. Like, I have problems with that. That's a conformity and things like that. Never been a fan.
We should recap what happened to you in your field.
Okay. Uh-oh, here comes the trauma, everyone. So after many years of job searching, as I kind of mentioned earlier, I was, got my doctorate. I thought I was going to go into higher ed and be tenured and be able to really speak and help my fellow colleagues. Spent almost 10 years adjunct teaching in places that would accept me. And during that time, doing all the work that tenured people were doing, but not being compensated for it, which was lovely.
This was in e-schools, right? This was in education schools?
Yes. Colleges. These are colleges of education, mostly at private Catholic universities. Those were the only places that were committed to things that I was committed to, which social justice being one of them, equity, which now means something different. So if the listeners don't become alarmed or afraid that I said that, but, you know, it used to mean fairness, but now it's something completely different.
What years were these that you were doing?
So this is in the 90s, early 2000s. That's that time period where I'm adjunct teaching and mostly working in teacher prep programs with teaching English speakers of other languages, teachers, administrators, staff members going into that field. I taught pragmatics and methodologies and things of that nature in those programs. Did a lot around digital learning because I've always been involved in the digital world, even pre-pandemic. And then I landed finally during the pandemic was when I landed my first tenure track position. And that was at a California community college. It was a temporary position. And so when that ended, I kind of had my foot in the door into the system, you know, and I was like, ooh, a whole new world, you know, opened up. And I applied to a position I saw for a neighboring college that was tenure track, not temporary, full time. And it was for a faculty director for the Office of Equity, Social Justice, and Multicultural Education. And those are all things that I had been well versed in, worked with people, supported throughout my teaching career. And so this was an ideal position for me because it's what I'd always done, faculty support, and in addition to teaching, you know, myself. And this was an institution-wide role. I was supposed to lead a transformation around those topics. And I came in, I was honest, I did my teaching demonstration about calling in over calling out because that's something that I'm committed to. And as I started to do my work, I was basically sabotaged by some really far left critical social justice ideologues that were on my tenure review committee and my dean as well, who was one of them. And so it was a really bad situation. I saw teachers and educators behaving in ways that I had never encountered in any of my other adjunct teaching jobs. I've done a lot of interviews since this all happened and people are like, how could you not know that this was? And I'm like, I really had not encountered people who were like gangsters who acted like they were had a turf they were protecting to you. So yeah, I was actually called a nasty turf and because I wouldn't put my pronouns in my email signature anymore. But there was name calling. I was called all kinds of things. There was profanity in my evaluation process because some of the people were angry with how I represented their viewpoints and you know, that I would dare to compare the work of Kendi to Sheena Mason or other people. Like I was wrong for that. How could I? I made Kendi look bad. I'm like, how did I make Kendi look bad? I put up a Venn diagram and people talked about it. How is that making a scholar look bad? And I had these just terrible conversations with my committee members. It was never a constructive process. It was never something where I was growing as a professional. It was, in fact, one of the most destructive processes I've been through. And it culminated with my termination after 2 years of a living nightmare. I told them I was not going to resign. I was like, this, you don't understand what I've sacrificed to get here.
Oh, they asked you to.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It was basically like, you don't belong here. You're not doing what we want you to do. I'm like, wait, how can you say that? Actually, people are coming to my workshops, people who've never engaged with the office before because it has a reputation of, quote, being too woke. That was the reputation that the office had when I came in. And when I asked them what that meant, they said that teachers were being accused of being a racist. They were being accused of being transphobic, that they weren't good teachers, that they weren't responsive to their students, that they needed to change how they do things to be more culturally responsive and inclusive. All kinds of things of that nature were being said to faculty members. And that's no way to get anyone to change what they're doing. In fact, they just dig in more when they're called those kinds of names and treated that way. So right away, I was trying to do things, bringing the different areas of the campus, because there are people who are not really far off the deep end on either side in the campus, people who are just kind of not wanting to get involved. They actually don't even go to Academic Senate. They just teach and they bounce out, like they have nothing else to do with it. They just want to teach their students. But some of those folks started to come out to my workshops and to get involved. And the people that were really far on the far left side of things became enraged that that was happening. And I was told I wasn't working with who I was supposed to work with. And I was like, well, who am I supposed to work with? And they're like, the racial affinity groups. And I'm like, but those are problematic. We only have four. And there's many more people of other races on this campus. And why are we doing that?
Could I ask? Because I'm supposed to be in the gender camp. I'm like, they don't let me sit by the fire anymore, though. Thank goodness. But the thing that I really hate about these affinity groups is that you have to have a certain mindset. You have to have a certain ideology to be considered a participant in that group. So it's not enough that you had a sex change when you were a teenager. It's not enough that you have been living 30 years as a trans person. You also have to believe all of the things that, by the way, people 15 years ago, they didn't believe. But you have to say the right things if you want to be a member in good standing or spokesperson for that affinity group. And so it turns them, I think you used the word gangsters or mobsters earlier. That's what it turns them into, these the gangsters. Mm-hmm. I hate these affinity groups. Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly how they function on that campus as well. And I've heard from so many people, that's how they're working in other places. How else could they work? I mean, they're founded on a philosophy that's based on division, continual struggle, strife. That's the basics of the whole worldview, if you will. And it's so problematic. And so when I raise questions like that, Perna, I said, because I came in as the Academic Senate was going to change their governance structure to give affinity groups voting rights in the Academic Senate.
Whoa. Yes.
And so I'm someone like, oh, I'm in the academy. I'm a professor now. I'm going to go to the Academic Senate. They're going to stand for all of us. That's me in my thinking. That's how I thought the academy was. And that's what I thought my teacher union was. Let's not go into that part yet. So it was. So when they were saying we're going to do that, I said, well, I thought the Academic Senate is overseeing. We have representatives from academic disciplines. And each of those departments and disciplines vote someone and they come and represent. I said, how are these four groups representative of everyone? And I started asking questions like, is this legal? I said, why are we giving such credence to affinity groups when not everyone joins them for various reasons, like you just pointed out? A lot of questions I asked, and I was told that I was destroying the equity progress by doing that.
What were these four affinity groups?
So we had a black faculty, staff, and administration network, which I was a member of, you know, right as a coming in. We had the name had changed. I call it Latinx Faculty Network. It's Latinx. That's how they say it, but it's not pronounceable in the Spanish language, and many people find it actually quite offensive. So I say Latinx because it's just ridiculous. And I tried to get to the bottom of, where did that come from? Why were we using that term and telling our students to identify themselves that way in student surveys? Got in trouble for asking those questions and digging in that black hole. Asian American and Pacific Islander. That was the
really they let them have an affinity group.
Yes, yeah.
They're the oppressors. They have to be sifted out.
Oh, I wasn't aware. So.
Well, they scored too high on tests, and that's not fair.
Oh, okay. So the school that I was at was a little bit different because they are AAPI majority. So at that school, students, not faculty representation, but students, if you're going to look at those categories and give any credence to them. So it was a little bit different than some other places in terms of that dynamic. But yeah, and then the third group was one that came up as this process came up. It was the LGBTQ plus group. So yes, that came as they said, we're going to give another vote. That became an affinity group. So
could you be in more than one affinity group? Could you be like Black and LGBTQ and Asian?
You have to pick.
And Latinx. It seems like yeah, you could you be all of pick. Those things.
Well, all the BIPOC groups are in solidarity, you know? Yeah. So that's, I learned that too. And I learned what BIPOC is. Just all these different.
Bisexual people of color. What? No, that's bi, right?
No.
Bi- oh, wait, no, we can, no, I'm wrong. I understand. We can't say bi because that implies there's two sexes.
Yeah.
I remember.
It's panpoc. It's panpoc now, Corinna.
It's panpoc. Oh. Right. Panpoc. Oof.
It's been so hard to keep up.
There's this wonderful Asian place down the street called Panpoc. No, I'm kidding.
Oh, we'll have to go.
It's pretty grody. It's
Corinna's pretty grody. Racist. You heard it here first, TERFs and trannies. Or probably not first.
No, it's probably now. It's been said. Well, the thing is, the word almost doesn't mean anything at this point.
No.
Because I have absolutely no doubts that there's racism, that it's common. And in some parts of the world, it's deadly. And it's very difficult to describe that now because racism is also asking somebody, hey, where do you come from? Wow. Right? So one word that's supposed to cover all of these different types of situations, it makes the word weak. So no doubt I've been called a racist, and it makes it difficult for me to assess whether I should take the accusation seriously.
Well, you're the worst kind of racist because you're white, but you're the worst kind of white, which is of Jewish heritage.
The worst type of Jewish heritage too, because it's from my father.
Yeah. Well, no, it might be worse if it were from your mother, because then you might you might have been raised even more Zionist or Zionist at all. Uh-oh. But that's the worst. The worst kind of white people are Jews. So they should be rounded up into camps or something. Sorry. We are digressing.
You do know I've been called a dirty Zionist as well as part of that experience. So
you have?
Yes.
I'm impressed. Yeah. How did that happen?
One of the labels. And then I was also called a far right shill. I'm like, what? When am I getting my check? Like, I just want to know because nobody told me. But yeah, it happens because so we have this group called the Equity Action Council. And as the faculty director for the Office of Equity, Social Justice, and Multicultural Education, like, you know, when you see a title like that, that's your red flag. Like, ooh, I'm in an ideologically captured zone because I should have known that. Now I know. But yeah, so I had to go, and we would spend 2 hours every week taking no action around equity. We did a lot of meditation. We did conocimientos, acknowledgements. We did a lot of chatting with each other, but no action. And
conocimientos?
Yes, that's like acknowledgements. So it would go like, I appreciate Corinna because, you know, this week she made sure that there was the transgender bathroom
was
open during the break. Thank you, Corinna. Everyone clap.
Okay.
Yeah. that's what that was. And so for me, I'm an action person. And so when a group came, one of our local Hillel organizations came and they presented to the Equity Action Council, telling them their concerns about the highly entrenched anti-Semitism on the campus. And they gave some recommendations. They said they had been coming for a long time trying to get changes. They gave examples. They had evidence. There was data. You know, this wasn't subjective stories or something like that. And then when we took it back to my team meeting and I said, what are we going to do about this? And I was told we weren't going to do anything about it. And I was just floored by that because of the things that were presented. And as the presenters were presenting, one of my staff members was saying, here's some resources to learn more about Jewish culture. And they were dropping in the chat box things like Students for Justice for Palestine. And then they dropped a link to Jewish Voice for Peace. And this was antithetical to what the speakers were speaking about and their concerns. And so when we were in our private meeting, I didn't do this public. I have no supervisory capacity. I'm just a fellow colleague, you know. And I said, hey, that was really rude to be dropping links that were like the direct opposite of what the speaker was saying, who was a guest, into the chat. And I was told, well, we have freedom of speech and we can say what we want. They were saying what they wanted. And then the response, that response coupled with me saying, let's take action, and being told, no, we're not going to do anything about these concerns. Jews are white oppressors, and we're not focused on that. We're focused on decentering whiteness. And I truly have not heard people speak that way before. This was in 2021. Apparently, it was popping off in a lot of places, but not the places I had been in. And it shocked me because this is a public school. And I kept saying, like, we're public. Like, we're not a private school. We can't just do what we want. We're on the public dime and we have a responsibility to everybody in the community. And if a community member comes to us, we should be responsive or take some kind of action, especially on things that aren't hard to do. Like, there are some things that were asked for that were simple that could be done in matters of minutes. And they just had a refusal and didn't participate in the education efforts. And around that time was when at department meetings, I was being referred to, colleagues came back and let me know as a dirty Zionist, and even in emails.
They were saying that Jews are white oppressors.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that is the viewpoint. That is a core viewpoint of a critical social justice like worldview. And that's why it's so problematic when it's being used in so many schools. And now we see what they produce in the streets with all these protests and things that are going on. And beyond the protests, even just the violent approach that's often used and supported. The rebel with a bunch of slogans that doesn't even have historical basis in fact to back up what they're saying. It's like repeating of things they've been taught and told. It's very obvious if you ever try to engage any of them in a conversation. It's really just concerning to me, the levels of that, how it persists, and how emboldened people were. And this was in 2021 on up till 2023. So this is before a lot of the things where people are now more aware and they're like, oh my gosh, you know, like I wasn't paying attention, but look what's happening on campuses. So this was early on and their problems stretched back earlier on. And I'm guessing it was that way on many campuses. I'm just so glad that these people are so self-righteous, thinking that they're the dominant force. That's what's so funny. They say, oh, we're pressing up against the powers. No, like you are the dominant power now. And you're not even seeing how you're treating your colleagues, how you're treating your neighbors, how you don't want any other perspective out there. No one else can even question, or you like you think they might not be in full lockstep, so they can't be with us anymore. This is like, not just can't be with us, but we want your job. We're coming for everything to destroy you, to neutralize you. And that's the part that worries me, because I can work with someone who like has completely different perspectives. It's called like being a professional. We can work together and we can collaborate and do our job to serve the students. Some people are like, no, they're self-serving and they're ideology serving. And that's what's most important to them. And anyone who's outside of that, there's no care. I've just never seen such heartless, mean spirited people, and petty, real petty.
And ugly.
Yes.
And with bad clothes and terrible manners and bad cooking. Mm.
You're just saying that because you're a white colonialist.
Oh my goodness.
So, Lee, it's my observation that all groups that have very strong ideological beliefs that bring them together, right? Yeah. So you take a group that doesn't have super strong ideological beliefs, like, I don't know, the Fraternal Order of Police. I'm sure they do have ideological beliefs, but they're not like super strong ones, because there's Democrats and Republicans and people on the left and people on the right. And then what they have in common is their profession, or I don't know, the ACM, the Association of Computing and Computing Machinery. Like, the, probably not very strong ideological stuff.
In computers? But, are you kidding?
No, I'm not kidding, because you still have a pretty large variety of viewpoints. They're not at all being brought together by ideology about, well, you know what? They do believe that there's only two states in binary. So I suppose that there is an ideology in computers. But when you're talking about the sorts of background that you are, Lee, when it's the ideology that knits everything together, I notice that infighting is like perpetually happening. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if your appearance in that context gave that group at that particular time something to see as an external threat, to put aside their quarrels so that they could fend off an outsider. Was there some of that happening?
There was definitely in-group bias happening. So when I started off, I did these needs assessment conversations. I ended up doing like over 60 hours of them. And this was during the pandemic. So that's why I was able to get people and talk to them that many for that much time. One of the first conversations I had was with a staff member for the office. So there was two staff members and the dean and myself. That was the equity office. And one of them revealed to me that they were a finalist for the position and that they felt entitled to it. They were a former student there. They had risen throughout the ranks. They're deeply committed to equity. They don't know who I am or what my commitments are. It was talk like that, you know, like, I don't know you. I've never heard of you. Nobody knows you. I tried to empathize with this person because right before I came on board and got this full-time thing, my temporary job, which I did a portfolio and everything, like I was thinking it's going to for sure get budget approval. I'm in, like it's temporary, but it will be approved and I'll move on to the next step of the process. I was devastated when it came back from their Senate at that other school, you know, like, hey, none of the instructional designers are staying on. We're done with the pandemic. We're going back to teaching in the classroom. We don't need those people. And so I shared that with them. And I said, you know, I'm here not to undermine anything you guys have done. I'm going to elevate and support it. I understand the heartbreak because I just experienced it. When you have a dream and you think for sure you have that position, and then something else happens, like a dark horse or a dark horse event, the response of that person wasn't like, hey, yeah, like, let's do this together. At the end, they said, I just want to let you know you're going to have a very rough road ahead of you. And they delivered on that. Oh. Yeah, they delivered on that. They were one of the primary orchestrators of a lot of the difficulties that happened initial on. So,
well, and has it happened that this person who antagonized you so much that people have turned on her?
So I won't reveal the pronouns.
Oh, this is going to be good.
Corinna, you assumed it was her. And I'm like, now why did you do that? Like, what is it about this scenario that made you think that?
I just call everybody. Oh. It's to be safe, because men won't be offended if you call them her, if they don't identify as her, but they'll be really pissed if you call them he. So I just call everybody her. So yeah, don't reveal the biological sex of this person or her make-believe gender identity.
I'm going to go with they, them for 500.
You still have some sense of self-preservation. Despite all of this, there's something left to preserve.
No, but this person was well known to the other people. And that's why my tenure review process just went, like, literally from the start was just a complete farce. It really was. People weren't happy I was there. And unfortunately, I am a very competent teacher. So they couldn't get me on, like, incompetence, unprofessionalism, like anything that you would normally like be like, this person cannot be our colleague. That wasn't there. It was purely ideological. Like the write-ups, I was shocked to see some of the things like, she offended my perspective. She should never broach controversial topics in her workshops. Okay, this is the Office of Equity, known for controversial topics and leaning into discomfort. Don't do it though. So it was the strangest experience. And initially I was writing like rebuttals. And one of my mentors actually said, like, Lee, they're not reading it. Like they do not care. You've written like 16 pages. It's in a file. They do not even look at it. And I was like, oh. So then after that, I started changing the margins and doing really small font and getting it down to 2 pages. Because I just could not say, like, this is, these are lies. Like, I can't just let it sit there.
Yeah. So what about people that were your friends before? People that you had connected with before all of this happened? Mm-hmm. Did they stand up for you, stick with you, defend you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, I have some, you know, some of my mentors from my doctoral days are still, you know, with me, have seen me go through some interesting things. Some of them were the ones who, so my first, when I started to speak about this, the first media outlet that would hear my story was Fox News. And it was the Tucker Carlson show. And when that hit, many people who knew me when I was teaching, who knew me for years, they were like on the phone. They were like, Lee, like, what is going on? Are you on Tucker Carlson? One person said, like, is this Armageddon? I was like, yeah, this is your signal that we're coming to the end when I'm there and I'm speaking to, you know, because that's just not something that anyone who knew me would expect to see. And there was a lot of shock, you know, around that. And there's been a lot of shock from my side, like since that time, because I literally, Nina, I've been willing to talk to whoever calls me or puts an email. I don't like research, like, who is it? Oh, I don't want to talk to that person. I'm afraid. Like, I'll speak to whoever, and I'll talk to whoever wants to talk to me. So I've been open to all media. What's really weird about my story and what happened to me, only what's classified in today's world as far right media has been interested, mostly. And yeah.
Hey, I just want to, I want to put this out here. Only Nina is far right.
Just because I'm right doesn't mean I'm far right. Okay.
I like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's strange. And I've seen from the back end, I used to teach about media literacy. I'm going to have to revise so much and update so much. Yeah, because it's, we're in a strange world right now.
I got it. Just, I was in journalism in high school. Like, that doesn't make you a journalist, but obviously it takes a certain sort of person who wants to be, I wanted to be in the journalism class. I want to like learn the, like, why and where and who and what and when and get all the facts down, and you don't put the editorializing in and yada, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. And it's amazing how important journalism is to the maintenance of our democracy. And the past 4 years, the past 6 years, 8 years, basically since the advent of Donald Trump, journalism has just gone completely cuckoo. Mm-hmm. And now, I'm sorry, I'm complaining about something personal here. Now, any topics that are written by a trans-identified author get to bypass the editorial desk and the fact checkers. That's happened at the Washington Post a couple of times now. And it's like, we're in a, what do they say? A post-truth world. We're in a post-truth world. You cannot count on the venerable news institutions to tell us the facts anymore. And it is very unsettling, because I remember what the conspiracy theorists sounded like back in the Clinton administration. Oh my gosh, the Clintons are killing off all of their enemies and rolling them in carpets and hiding them in parks. And like, how can you listen to this and not think these people are complete crackpots? But now when I listen to the news, I'm like, I know this stuff isn't fact-checked anymore. I know these claims that I'm hearing are tenuous. NPR has completely fallen apart. Washington Post can't be trusted. The New York Times, there's an ongoing battle there, and I don't think the battle's over yet, but I don't believe the news anymore.
Yeah, for sure. Because from the backside, you know, I have a lot of respect for journalists, and I really thought they were like people who look through all the evidence and they try to get all the perspectives and sides and they present a well-rounded view of the topic.
Yes.
But what I've experienced on the back end of being someone who's been interviewed, who spent like with one newspaper, which was actually a left-leaning newspaper. So I was so excited. I'm like, you know, first time this has ever happened. Spent over 20 hours of interview time and document sending and emailing with one of these journalists. And I thought they were just like really going in. They're investigating, right? And they're going to report the truth of what took place. And instead, it when it was supposed to publish, it took like 2 weeks around that process. And I was like, okay, is this going to publish? Like, I want to tell my mom and dad to go get the paper, like the actual physical paper, so I can put it in a scrapbook. You know, this was that kind of thing. And after 2 weeks of just waiting and waiting, the story was done. The person got back to me with questions from their editors. And the questions from the editors, this is what was holding it up. They were questions like, why did you go on Tucker Carlson when he is a known racist and you are supporting racism by even appearing on that show? And when I saw those kind of, this is what's holding this about my story of what happened with my termination, something that happened after that. And that's what they were focused on. I don't think they liked my response very much because I was like, this, you're not a truth seeking or truth telling apparatus. You're an ideological apparatus, because what is that guy and that interview have to do with what happened to me and all the things I shared with you, the documents, the evidence, and so forth? It has nothing to do with it. It truly doesn't. And they're not focused on the facts of the story. And when the story came out, it was devastating. It was like basically a hit piece on me. And I was like, oh, wow. It was so deflating, disappointing. And I'm not jaded, but I'm a little more like, careful with my time, because no matter how much time you spend trying to share things with people and thinking that they're looking them over, most likely they're not. And they've already like written the story before they even get to you. And they're just filling in some blanks where the editors want to sprinkle in some quotes from you or twist them up, whatever it is. So
is this mostly how you spend your time now, informing about the state of academia, I guess, or DEI?
Yes. So I'm very thankful, because some people tried to destroy my career and like bury me, and they actually made me reach even more people, like more than I could have ever imagined. So I'm thankful to be able to talk to people about the ideologies that underlie things like DEI, current teaching in the default mode in most K-12 and higher ed classrooms, at least in the places that we all know about. And I'm able to do that and work on things like the Empowered Social Justice Resources, which I share with you all too, and trying to make alternatives and give teachers alternatives so they know that there's a lot of complaining about what teachers are doing, but there's no like, here's something else to try, or here's another way to approach. And so that's what I've really turned my focus to, because that's always been my passion, you know, teacher education, co-learning, curriculum development. I feel like we've lost that, and I want to get us back to those important foundations and that kind of work. So.
And are you working independently, or are you working with organizations?
So I do. Did you hear the hesitation in that? So I am with Do No Harm as a senior fellow, and I help them understand DEI in the medical training and profession. I'm really loving that. I'm also a co-founder of Free Black Thought. So that is an organization that elevates heterodox Black thinkers and issues around the topics of like culture, world, you know, American life. Those are two things I'm really passionate about. I recently had a temporary directorship of the Coalition for Empowered Education, and that contract is wrapping up in May. There's many of us independents with wrapping up contracts right now, and we're thrilled about it. So that's just how that's going. but yeah, and it's been a great, that those kind of things, and my work with my consultancy, of course, which I've been doing for quite a while, those are exciting for me, because that's working with schools, with districts, with teachers. I'm in my element, sometimes with students and administrators. So
what is your consultancy?
So it's called Dr. T. Lee Educational Consultancy. I've had it since I graduated with my doctorate. So I've had it for many years, even when I was doing adjunct. And I've done a lot of just like training, professional development, evaluation work for people. But now it's going to be really focusing on the resources I've developed for the Empowered Social Justice Resources, because I think that this is something that's in schools, whether we like it or not, I've gotten some feedback from people and they're like, it just social justice shouldn't even be in schools. You know, like there's that perspective and it's a real perspective. But the problem with it is that it is in schools and it's in many places throughout the nation, K through 12 and higher ed. So we can just keep saying like, it's get it out and like burn it, get it, you know, like get rid of it. DEI must die, all those slogans. But in the meantime, there's still students who are being impacted. And we can just yell about it and try to legislate about it. But in the meantime, there's lives that are being affected by teachers that are overemphasizing, unfortunately, race and gender identity checkboxes with students as young as kindergarten, all the way up through 12th and onward. It's a life path.
We'll have some woke kindergartners.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Well, kids get it. See, it's not hard. You just tell kids that you can change your gender and sex.
Yes.
They get it.
Yeah, every kindergartner needs to know about the cis hetero patriarchy. These are things that are natural for 5 and 6 year olds to consider. Piaget would agree.
You really would. Yeah. Hey, if little girls aren't afraid to see my penis in the locker room, why should adult women be?
Judith Butler wants to know, who does it bother? Who is affected by that, really?
Right.
It's okay.
Yeah, where's the wound? What's the wound? Don't answer that, Corinna.
It's not a wound. It's healed. It's healed. I was on my company's inclusion and diversity committee because I know this will sound like I'm taking the piss to some people listening, but I actually do believe that there's value in improving inclusion and diversity, especially at companies that have a very long history and fairly static company culture that hasn't allowed a lot of outside perspectives to come in and inform the culture. So I do think that that is important and can be valuable. One of the reasons that I participated is that my background is in web page design. And as part of that, you have to be aware that many of the people who have to access media don't have the same visual capabilities as a lot of us take for granted. So I was frequently giving feedback saying, hey, you can't send out company-wide emails that are just pictures because there's no text description. You have to make these accessible for people who are vision impaired. I believe in that. You should be aware of everybody at your company should have the same opportunity to understand everything that the corporation is sending out, right? So I think that's an inclusion and diversity matter. And I think it is important. So I don't think it's worth throwing away inclusion and diversity, but it has become like a cancer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
No, go on.
Oh, no, you reminded me of, you know, in Ibram Kendi's book, he talks about establishing a federal department of anti-racism. And it just seems like we're so close to that right now. We're even tearing up Title IX right now. So it's amazing to me and saddening some of the things that are happening from like the governmental level. And I think that if more people were aware of had their civic knowledge and civic competency intact, that it wouldn't be happening like this. But we have a whole generation who hasn't gotten that. And we failed them in a way by not providing that as a foundation. It's so important and critical. And without us as citizens understanding that, other people can come in and supply flags of other nations in our capital and do all kinds of things that just would not have been acceptable in previous times where people were more aware and vigilant and protective and celebratory. And now, you know, when I talk about things like that, people say, oh, yeah, you're sounding far right. But I'm really not. I'm not willing to give. I'm just not willing to give some things to the right or the left or anyone, you know, like some things are just like, if you're here, like that's a basic. And to me, civic competency, being involved, like those are basics.
Right. Your political party has nothing to do with your citizenship. Yeah. In fact, it's completely optional.
Mm-hmm.
You're no matter what party you affiliate with or political ideology that you prefer, mm-hmm. if you were born in this country or if you've become naturalized, you're an American.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's not far right. That's not fascist. It's a fact. It's weird to think that it has like white nationalism to acknowledge that somebody has a belongs to a nation.
Little subject change here. You mentioned calling in versus calling out. Can you explain what that is?
Yes. So this is going back to when I did my teaching demonstration for the job that I was terminated from after a couple of years. So they told me that the office I would be working for was a little too woke. And I asked them to define it. I told you about that definition that they gave me. And so I saw that as one of their like pain points. And I was reading all these books about interviews and how to be successful because I really wanted to be successful and land a full-time tenure track position. That was like my life goal. I did my teaching demonstration based on their pain point, and I was talking to them about how do we engage in courageous conversations? How do we engage in conversations that are complex, where divergent viewpoints may surface, and where we have to actively listen to each other and actually hear what the other person's saying and dialogue more. And calling out is just when you're like, when you go to the board of trustees without ever talking to Lee during her first 6 months of employment, and you spend 15 minutes of public comment time, one person after another speaking and saying she should be fired. She is undermining the equity progress of our school. She's not supporting racialized affinity groups. She said all lives matter, which I never said. But yeah, just a bunch of things, you know, that were invented. That's a calling out because those people never came and talked to Lee and said, hey, what did you mean when you said this? Or when you asked that question, what was up with that? It was just a mass action to eliminate, to destroy, to kick out, cast out. That was the purpose of it. That's a calling out, a canceling. And so calling in is more inquiry based. It's not assuming that you know what someone was meaning or thinking or what their intention was. And there can be comments about intention and impact and all that too. We can go round and round in circles with a lot of our micro and macro aggressions, if you believe in that. That was the kind of dynamic that was there. And in environments where there is that ideological capture, you see a lot of calling out all the time. And it's done like to make an example, I think, of people. You step out of line, well, you're next. You know, like, do you want this to be you? Like, it's very public in nature. And so that's why I did that, the calling in over calling out, because that's my approach. And that's what I try to help people to cultivate in organizations. If you want to have a functional, thriving, inclusive organization, that means, I mean that differently than critical social justice means it. I mean, like where everyone is welcome and included there. It's tough in that kind of environment, but they apparently liked what I did enough, right, to bring me on. And that was always the mystery. Like, why was that even a thing? If you weren't going to support, you knew it was a tough environment. You're telling me that in the interview process. And then, you know, people are going to be resistant when you try to start bringing people together, identifying common points, having people talk to each other who had stopped talking to each other because of like ridiculous things, you know, social media, a big part of it. It's a very toxic environment to be in when you are coming from an alternate perspective of like, hey, I'm going to like double click that, or I'd like to know more. I want to understand what you're saying. It doesn't mean I'm going to agree and like, or any of that. It just means I'm willing to listen.
So calling in, I mean, I know what calling out means. Calling in, is that like checking in? Is it like one-on-one conversations? Is it?
It's a more inquiry.
To communicate.
Mm-hmm. More inquiry based, actively listening to someone, asking them questions about, you know, whatever the concern or issue is, clarifying, seeking dialogue, meeting with people and trying to build understanding.
We could try an exercise right now. Lee, why are you a dirty Zionist?
Well, I was.
Did yes, I do it right?
Yeah.
Oh, yay!
Yeah. That would be a nice one. But then we could get into like, was that question was disingenuous because of whatever else and my feelings.
Oh, your feelings. That's what I keep finding. The one difference, because I'm going like, okay, everybody in this culture fight, this woke versus everybody else culture fight, everybody feels like they're right. Mm-hmm. Everybody believes they're informed. Everybody is highly concerned. But the act...
Nina, there's one more thing. We all believe that we know what everyone else is thinking.
Maybe.
Sorry, go on. Well,
maybe.
You know, because we say, oh, well, you hate blah, 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 or you think blah, blah, blah.
Well, that's one side of it that seems to be doing that. Seems a little less curious. But the big difference, I think, is one side uses emotional reasoning always. And the other is trying to present evidence or is valuing evidence and tries to make more reasoned, rational arguments. And there's a friend of ours who's been documenting the goings on of the Colorado State House. And we had a episode a few weeks ago with a little bit of audio from that. And the difference, like the emotionality of the people supporting these policies that I consider genuinely dangerous, they're getting rewarded. And recently I was at a law school with a friend of mine who's a judge. And at the law school here, emotionality was rewarded. Like when there was a Q&A, if a student was like near tears and saying, oh, they're trying to make us all disappear. And the law professor was like, I am so sorry. I just hope people learn empathy. And I'm just like, at a law school?
Yeah.
So this is happening places that I would not, state houses and law schools, that's supposed to be where like the rational stuff is.
Mm-hmm. And medical schools, right? I would hope.
Oh, yeah.
I would hope.
Yeah, and hospitals too, right? Like there are supposed to be like safeguards for patients, mm-hmm, because, you know, they're supposed to know that you can harm people if you don't do that. But instead it's like, oh, your pronouns. Let's affirm them.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's like the best I can do in terms of the difference, because we keep trying to make rational arguments and statements, and they mean nothing in the face of a crying person holding a cane and a support animal.
Yes. Yeah. And sometimes not even just that, you know, because one of my tenure review committee members, they cried because I'd hurt them so much by offending them ideologically. Misrepresenting their ideology was what it was called. It was just direct quotes from sources. I didn't say if they're good or bad. They were just quotations without commentary. Yeah. Strange universe.
So what's next?
Nina, you have something, it seems like.
Well, I wanted to ask a question. I wanted to ask a different question before the what's next question, because that's supposed to be the last question.
Oh, no.
I wanted to ask, how have you changed since you first, since this first happened and you brought attention to it?
Yes. How have I changed?
Sorry, that was my fault. I was making snapping gestures, and
Corinna was validating me from the audience. Yeah.
I was. Sorry, visual joke.
Yes. And see, now I forgot the question because I was laughing.
Okay, how have you changed since your journey, since your gender journey started? your gender culture.
Well, you know, I was one of the early proponents of pronouns in online teaching and spaces. Like this is in like CompuServe, IRC, BBS days, when you could not see each other. And so that carried along into, you know, the early part of my teaching and learning and things of that nature. I never told students that they had to do it or anything like that, like we're doing now. But now I completely reject it. It's gotten ridiculous. It's a misuse and abuse of the English language. It's so many things that are just bizarre, the way it's being used and weaponized, and all in the name of making everyone feel included. But some of the people I know who are, they call themselves gender fluid. I know we can contest that term, but that's what they call themselves. They say that kind of constant pronoun prompting, and I have to tell you and you tell me, it's like distressing to them. So I thought to myself, that's no good. I'm not being kind to keep engaging in that when some people that it's supposed to be helping, it's actually harmful. And if you put yourself in a perspective of someone who does identify in that way, that is very distressing. You're going to be prodded every moment, every day, wherever I go, in my email, this and that. Like, I have to say my pronouns before my name even. No, that's ridiculous. And I have to assume an identity that goes along with that. And now we have the neo-pronouns. I don't even know what that's all. We're telling people how to talk about us when we're not even there. Teachers are teaching students things that are not grammatically correct. I'm a former English, civics, and social studies teacher. So for me, like, that's, I'm like, no, we're not going to do that linguistic game. It's ridiculous. I don't participate anymore. I think I ranted a little. I did not mean to rant, but it's something that's really bothered me. What other ways? I meditate a lot more. I engage in mindfulness practices more. I talk to people more, which is odd because I'm an introvert. So, but now I get into interactions with people, and that's good. Because I can put together, you know, those skills that I always taught my students to use too. And so those are ways I've changed, just like continuing to, I'm even more of myself. I'm not afraid. I don't have anything hanging over me or that I'm trying to do that's more important than everything. You know, like, no, I've really just shifted perspective on that. The wellness of myself and people around me and our country, that's more important to me than some of the other things used to be.
Awesome. I can relate to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like, if you don't do that, you go crazy.
Yeah.
Okay. Now you can ask the question, Corinna.
Lee, so what's next?
Well, I'm excited. I'm doing a virtual launch for the Empowered Social Justice Resources. I'm talking about a lot because this really... it's a culmination of everything I've done in terms of teacher training, shifts we need in the current moment, involving civics and combating some of the negativity, the anti-racist, anti-capitalist, anti-Semitic, anti-colonialist perspectives that are in classes. Like, the anti-ness is something that I think is very toxic, and it demotivates students. It doesn't help them to achieve academically. I'm someone who's always been focused on that. I'm a little bit of an overachiever. Oh. So if you haven't noticed, that's something that I enjoy. And so I'll be having that launch on June 1st. I have a little link for registration on my website if people want to check it out. But hoping that to connect with districts, teachers, and so forth, and in the fall be out in schools training and supporting and helping this to be used in whatever way. It's a very flexible framework. So I already have some interest. Some people are talking about using it as part of their advisory period. So that's at K-12, they have like a homeroom, but a lot of schools have converted that to where they talk about social justice. They talk about racial justice circles and restorative circles and all these kind of things. Well, they're talking about adapting the framework for empowered social justice and using the standards that I've developed to talk about the topics in a more classical social justice way. And by that, I mean, it's rooted in liberal democratic values and those foundational documents like the U.S. Constitution and others. That's what I'm really excited about doing. And that's what's up next for me. I'm independent in that. Just looking forward to getting things rolling. Like, that's what's next for me. Onward and upward, you know?
Awesome. Well, you're awesome.
Thank you.
You are fun. You are so sparkling and fun and smart.
Thank you.
I'm so glad that you joined us today.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, they didn't take my sparkle fun away. Like, some of it's just so absurd. It, like, you have to laugh. It's like, what? Is this real? Are we really doing this right now? And sometimes it feels like we're in a bad movie in recent days. So I just...
All right. I have one more question. You can edit this out.
It's too late.
It's too late. I'm going to ask it anyway.
Thanks,
no.
But thanks, Terps. Goodbye.
No. All right. So why do you think you did not join that Borg? What is it about you when so many people that we know, well, at least so many people that I knew, friends and family, people I grew up with, they're either like passively nodding to it, but more they're really into it. Like they actually believe this stuff and they've gotten a lot more extreme. Mm. And it's like, how did this happen to almost everyone that I know and not me?
For that, I would really say it's the teaching that I had and that I kind of brought into my teaching. So I was always focused on like science fiction and, you know, things that were supposed to be about the future, but some of it we're living now, dystopian like type, you know, novels and so forth. A lot of Orwell and Handmaid's Tale, which is now a series that everyone's watching, but the books are what you want to, two books. And Ray Bradbury and people like that. Like that's what I experienced. And so I was always kind of future forward, future thinking, fascinated with possibilities. What's next for humanity? Those are always things I've been like, just like enthralled with. And so I think that shapes kind of me now. Like every day we wake up and there's something new or some new legislation or some new demand upon us from the orthodoxy that we not do. It's just uncanny to me how it feels like we're living some of the books like Brave New World and, you know, other books that were before just parts of imagination. So.
But my childhood friends read all those books too and loved all those books. And they're big proponents of this stuff.
Well, they didn't spend a lot of time with Eliza like I did. So those are my childhood friends.
No, they actually, when you say Eliza, you mean the computer program?
Yes.
Yeah, no, one of my friends introduced me to Eliza and he is one of the biggest cultists out there.
How does that make you feel that one of your friends is one of the biggest cultists out there? That's an Eliza joke.
I know that. I know.
I know, but not everybody listening will know that that's an Eliza.
Yeah, like none of this protected them. Like none of the educational stuff, the philosophical stuff, the critical thinking stuff, none of this protected them. None of this stopped them. They are unhinged now. And maybe they're on a podcast saying the same thing about me. Like, oh, you know, Nina, oh my gosh, she was like us. And look at her. She's like a TERF that is the worst kind of white supremacist because she's Jewish. And she's interviewing Lee, who's a dirty Zionist. How did that happen?
By the way, we cannot use that as the title, Nina.
Dirty Zionist.
I'm just striking that one right now.
Oh, yeah.
Because like I haven't found anything, you know, educational or anything that could be communicated that keeps people from falling into this.
We really have to get back to understanding foundations of things, I think. We've jumped like many leaps. Things have advanced really quickly recently. And people haven't thought critically about it. They just haven't. They've reacted.
They think they have. They think that they, and what they do is they project all of this on us. Like anything that we can say, any critique that they get, they flip it around.
Yeah.
Like if they were listening to this, they'd be like, oh, listen to those hateful bigots and their emotional arguments.
Oh.
Like they would hear, if we're being rational, they would hear this hatred. They would project that onto it. So no, that doesn't work either. Like these people used to, I thought they used to be critical thinkers. I thought that I learned some of my foundations of critical thinking from them, but I'm very confused now.
There's still hope to turn it around. I think we have to start in education. We have to start. We've lost, not lost, but a whole generation is at risk. And I hate to use that because that reminds me of the nation at risk argument for standardized testing. So I'm not doing that. Don't worry. I haven't flipped that much, everybody. But I just want to point out that it starts there. And we can't just complain and point at the teachers and say what they're doing wrong in the schools and they're ruining everything, homeschool your kids. Like, not everyone's going to be able to do that. We have to take care for what we do have, and we have to make sure that people are getting the language to describe what they're experiencing, getting support in how do you take perspective and step back from something that grips you emotionally, because subjectivity is really being weaponized by some folks, and quite effectively. And so we have to really educate on that. How do you stay squared within yourself? How do you build an identity that's value-centered and not identity checkbox-centered? And so we've raised up a generation that sees themselves on the oppression wheel. That's problematic. You know, it's problematic in many ways, like for their own personal development and for our development as a community. I'm not someone who's saying like, we don't need anyone else, stand on your own and all that. But I do support individualism, and I support the individual person as well as, you know, my community. That's just where I'm at, and what I hope to keep sharing with people, creating points of dialogue, creating spaces for it, and talking and working together to change how we're engaging our students. That's like the most important thing to me, but I'm a little biased because that's my like my little world.
Well, that is a good note to end on.
Thank you.
So thank you so much for being with us, Lee, and TERFs and Trannies. Thank you for listening.
Wait, I have one more.
Okay, go for it.
Okay, I do have one more question. Ha ha! The show will never end.
False endings. I like it. We're like Hollywood. It's like a Hollywood movie.
It is. This is like you wait for all the credits, and then I'm going to introduce the next villain from the next episode. Nice. No, it's not going to be like that. I am skeptical that public schools can be saved. Between increasing funding for schools or cutting back the scope of what falls within public education, like cutting out social and emotional learning programs or diversity like what has to happen to make public schools, like what is the argument for keeping public schooling? Like what has to happen to preserve public schools?
That's a
it's
huge
just a small question. It's a yes. This is a yes or no question.
I really want to. That felt like Representative Stefanik for a minute. Oh, no, don't do that. That's the end, Corinna. Okay, let me. I'm back. Okay. I just want to say. I think it's something that's incumbent upon like each district in each area. Some people would look at California, where I'm from, and they say it's you guys are done. Like it's lost. You can never repair
nuke it.
Like it's completely captured. But there are pockets in California that aren't like what you see on the news or, you know, what you're seeing out there, the craziness of California. And those are the pockets where I will likely start with my work. I'm going to start with early adopters. Who is willing? Who wants to? I'm not trying to persuade anyone. I'm presenting something, an option to them. And I think that that is key because right now we can't really separate. I mean, well, we can. But I'm just saying, like, let's give them another chance to, like, prove, like, we're decent people. We're not, like, crazy anti-American communists, you know, anti-Semitic people who want to, like, destroy all. Like, I'm trying to give an out where people can say, okay, we'll try something different. And we'll try to really be inclusive of all in the way we approach things. We'll try to really understand the contested nature of race and ethnicity in America. And that none of these things are truth or facts, but some people have presented it and taught us that they are. Gender identity, same thing. Suddenly we're all talking about it. And we're talking about terms that 10 years ago, most people wouldn't have known unless they were in like a women, gender, and sexuality department or class or something like that. So I think that we've shown our ability to adopt even a whole linguistic framework that is ideological towards one way of thinking. I think there's hope for people to still unlearn and learn something new, adapt to a new reality if it's presented. So
okay.
Did I answer that?
Well, I think so. Let me reflect it back.
I think I gave Una a headache. She's like, you know, this is way off what we just
said. No. Let me do some reflective listening and make sure I understood this.
Okay.
So maybe there are some schools or school districts that are so far gone, it's not worth trying to fix them right now. But maybe what we do is we start with the places that haven't lost all hope yet. And we try to contain the damage and reverse it, and then demonstrate by example a better way of approaching whatever we're trying to teach young people, and showing some of these really failed districts, actually, here's some role models that you can use to start to repair yourself if you ever decide to. And that's what you're saying is don't throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah. And we can't force anyone to change. They have to be willing. Something has to spark within them. And they have to, like you said, see a model, see a demonstration. If it's a moral courage issue where they're like, no one else is doing that, you know, like, I'm not going to do something that no one else is doing. That's the way a lot of educators feel. You know, we're part of communities. Like, that's so important to us. And so make alternative communities. Start with one person. Whoever wants to come, hey, it's open. That's how I approach things like that. And I think even just one by one changes are massive changes, because we're in this environment where it's becoming like we're all the same, thinking the same, doing the same. Don't deviate. From the people who say, we want everyone to deviate. It's cognitive dissonance is at an all-time high on a daily basis.
Be a light unto the school districts.
Thank you.
You dirty Zionist. Oh, no.
There's the title.
Yes. Yes. And as a right-wing shill, I have to do that.
Right, or they won't pay you.
Right, yes. Please send me my check.
Us too. We're waiting.
I got a meal once.
You got a what?
I got a mule once.
You got a mule?
A meal.
Where's my mule? Oh, a meal. I thought you said a mule.
No.
Oh, a meal.
No.
Okay. All right.
Was it at a high end?
I mean, no. It wasn't Denny's.
Oh, no.
It wasn't Denny's, so I can't complain too much.
Yeah, okay.
Nice.
Well, I'm still waiting for mine, so.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, Lee, thank you so much for joining us. And Nina?
Thank you.
Thank you again for joining us. And again, TERFs and Trannies, thank you for listening to Heterodorks.
Bye.
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 Hey, women. By women, I mean adult human females. There's a new event called RISE, Reigniting Intergenerational Sisterhood Everywhere, which will take place on the land, the original Michigan Women's Music Festival land, this July 30th through August 4th. Workshops will include topics in intergenerational lesbian community building, feminist and political organizing, continuing the legacy of the women's movement, and intersectional approaches. We aim to build trust through open sharing and respectful listening in this focused, intimate setting. Aside from the core programming, RISE offers the chance to bond in person with other women during concerts, dances, movies, coffeehouse, open mics, skill shares, and swaps. We each bring our energy and gifts to the land and leave with new friends, skills, and ideas. Ticket sales end on Sunday, July 21st. No tickets will be sold at the gate. RISE is for adult human females only, and all applicants will be vetted. To apply, please email Char, that's C-H-A-R, at riseontheland2020s@gmail.com. That's riseontheland, all one word, lowercase, no space, 2020s@gmail.com. Please tell her you heard about it on Heterodorks. That will help us learn whether this PSA is effective. Thanks.